Well, good evening, everyone. I'm happy to be here, and if anybody had told me a year ago that I was going to become an expert, and I'm not an expert by any stretch, but I would be spending my daily routine dealing with a power line, I would have shaken my head. I spend my time with the Forest Society doing two things. I manage our 50,000 acres of timberland that we own statewide, and I run our public policy shop, which is kind of a polite way of saying I'm a lobbyist. And most of the issues I spend time lobbying on are land conservation related or forestry related. And not that power lines aren't, but it's certainly an interesting deviation from the norm. I'm going to talk tonight about the project, and I'm just curious, how many of you have more than a superficial knowledge of this, just out of curiosity? Okay, I'm not going to try and cover all the basics in great detail, but to get started, this project is a private enterprise that was created by Northeast Utilities and NSTAR, which is a distribution utility in Massachusetts. Northeast Utilities is one of the larger New England investor-owned utilities. They created a New Hampshire limited liability corporation called Northern Pass LLC to build, locate, and operate this 180-mile transmission line in the state of New Hampshire. 140 miles of it is a direct current line that starts up at the international border where Pittsburgh and Quebec meet, and it comes down to Franklin, where there will be a large converter station built that will convert this direct current into alternating current, and then there will be a new alternating current line, high voltage alternating current line, built from Franklin to a distribution center that Public Service Company owns in the town of Deerfield. And the major, or the only funder of this project today, is a Crown-owned corporation in the province of Quebec called Hydro-Quebec, which is one of the largest utilities in North America.
Question?
Yeah?
When did this get started? I'm just curious because I've only heard about it within the last year, and I just wondered how long it's been moving.
It's hard to say when this particular project's genesis was. It was announced publicly for the first time last October by Public Service Company in Franklin. And it had been developed probably for at least 3 years before then among the partners. And, you know, the Forest Society was actually first alerted to this project back almost 2 years ago now, when we were asked by the utilities if we would be willing to share information about conservation lands, which we said we would, making clear that just by sharing this information, they shouldn't read that to mean that we were taking a position on the project. But it started at least 2 or 3 years ago. My suspicion is that Hydro-Quebec has been working for, you know, 20 or 30 years on a variety of ways to get their power to the American or to the New England grid. And this just happens to be the latest iteration of a plan to get some of this power to the grid. The way that the project proponents look at this, this project is going to be in service in 2015, which means it has to get through the regulatory process, the land acquisition process, and a host of other construction project processes in a very short period of time. When this was announced in October, I think there was an expectation on the part of Northern Pass that they would have a completed environmental impact statement by this time next year. The Department of Energy has informed us and anybody else who attended the hearings that they expect to have a draft environmental impact statement done in a year's time, and that's probably being optimistic. So the point is that there is a fairly significant period of time through which this project will have to go through regulatory processes in order to get the permits it needs to get to go to construction if it gets to that point. I must say that in the process of trying to educate myself about this project, when I went to the Hydro-Québec website, I was floored. I had read newspaper accounts of what they were building over the last 30 or 40 years up there. I had no idea how large a company this is, how large the installations are. The installed capacity, which means that's the if they were generating power from every generating station that was operable today, they would generate 36,000 megawatts of electricity. Now, to put this into some perspective, on the busiest day in the last 5 years, the peak demand of power in the New England grid was 28,000 megawatts. So you get a sense of the scale of what Hydro-Québec is all about. They've flooded over 7 million acres of land to create impoundments to feed these run-of-the-river hydroelectric generating stations. And that's larger than the state of New Hampshire. In 2008, according to their annual report, they exported 8% of the electricity that they generated that year, which actually accounted for 22% of their net revenue. The telling thing here is that the plan that Hydro-Québec has to keep its own power cheap in Quebec is to export the surplus power that they have the capacity to generate to the south, and in some cases to other Canadian provinces. Their goal, according to their, yeah. So the question is, there are a lot of unanswered questions about this. We're going to cover. I'm going to try and cover, and that's one of them. The size of the company, $60 billion in net assets. That's the accumulated valuation of all of their power plants, and it makes it bigger than any utility in North America, and financially, this is just to give you an idea. This is one of the new projects that's being built on one of the rivers that. Forms a watershed that drains into James Bay. This is on the East Main River. This project will generate over 1,000 megawatts of new electricity in about 18 months. And this is, I think they have a total of 54 installations generating hydroelectric power. Not all of them are this large. This is one of three turbines that will be in this one section over here, and I don't know if you can see, but those are people right there. So it gives you an idea of how big these generating units actually are. Now, this is a map that identifies the power line corridors, the preferred and alternate corridors that Northern Pass is proposing for New Hampshire. The main corridor, the preferred corridor, comes in Pittsburgh, and it runs for about 40 miles down to Groveton, and that's all new a corridor that's going to be needed to build this line. There's no existing right-of-way there that they propose to add on to. They're totally creating a new power line and a new corridor. And when you get south of Groveton, for most of the corridor that they've identified as preferred corridor is actually on existing rights of way owned by Public Service Company of New Hampshire. There are a couple of deviations. There's one up here to the north that would require new right of way. This deviation is about 50 or 60 miles that goes around the White Mountain National Forest, this corridor goes right through the National Forest. And so they've identified an alternative if they can't get around the National Forest or can't get permitted to go through the National Forest. And I'll talk more about that in a minute. And then down here, the Concord Airport, if the FAA doesn't allow these tall towers, which down there are going to be 135 feet tall, then they're going to have to find an alternate route around the airport. So they're proposing to go through Loudoun and Chichester and Pittsfield, and then over through Epsom, and then over to the endpoint here, which is Deerfield. Now, the thing that's most amazing about this is that this proposed power line is very close to an existing high-voltage direct current line that Hydro-Quebec already uses to ship power down here. We'll get more show you a map of that in a second. But this is the proposed line, and you can see that it pretty much bisects the central part, northern part of the state. Now, I'm going to run through these slides very quickly, but this is to show you the alternate route around the national forest, because it impacts this particular part of the state pretty directly. The preferred line would go down here through the national forest, down through Easton and Lincoln and Woodstock. The alternative line would go through Llandaff, Bath, the southeastern corner of Bath, Haverhill, directly through the eastern side of Haverhill, Pyrmont, right through the middle, through a corner of Orford. Oops. Wentworth. Sorry. Groton. Plymouth. And then it reconnects with down in Bridgewater with the preferred line that would otherwise go directly north-south along 93. And this is all, with a small exception, would be all new corridor, new right-of-way that would have to be acquired. Now, this is a map that we prepared at the Forest Society, and I have copies of this here if people would like to leave with one. But this, the one of the purposes of this map, this is the preferred line that Northern Pass has identified from Pittsburgh to Deerfield. This is the corridor that exists presently. And when you look at this map, I mean, the first question I asked myself when I saw this was, why on God's green earth would you build another scar down the middle of the state when there already is a scar? And if you go, I mean, I admit that I'm just enough to be dangerous. I'm not an engineer. I'm not an electricity specialist. But I did do a little bit of research. This power line right here carries 2,000 megawatts. This one would carry 1,200 megawatts. There is technology today that allows a single power line to carry between 5 and 9,000 megawatts of high voltage direct current power. Now, it may be that there are issues on the ground that are a problem. You know, this power line right here is owned by National Grid, which is a competitor of Northeast Utilities. So obviously, you know, if they shared there, they'd have to share money. And there's a lot of money involved here. But the point here is that, you know, certainly from the Forest Society's perspective, one of the reasons that we've come out so strongly and loudly against this proposal is that we don't think this corridor has even been looked at with any scrutiny to determine if there's any possible way of using that corridor to accomplish the goals of this project. And I'm not saying that we would support that either. I'm just saying that, you know, from the get-go, it seems to us that at the very least there should be an exhaustive study to determine whether above ground, below ground, combination of the two should be looked at with that particular line. There are a whole bunch of questions that this project raises, and I'm not going to go into any of these with huge, great detail, but, you know, private gain versus public benefit. The project as it's proposed is a private company proposing to build a resource on privately owned land, which and many landowners who I know have no intention of voluntarily selling rights of way to the power company. So they're going to have to, if they're going to build it the where they want to, they're going to have to use eminent domain.
And I think there's a very legitimate question as to whether constitutionally in the state of New Hampshire that's even doable. But that issue won't be joined until, unless and until somebody actually proposes to take someone's land, at least not at the moment. There is a bill in the legislature, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit, that gets directly at that. The public benefit here is a real question, and it's related to not just do we need the energy? That's one very big unanswered question. At least it's not answered by the project proponents. I think it's pretty easy to answer for those of us who do a little bit of homework and realize that if every energy generating station in New Hampshire were operating at the same time, we'd be generating 4,000 megawatts of electricity. And on an average day as a state, we consume about 1,200 megawatts. So we clearly don't need the power. New England as a whole, New England, that earlier slide mentioned that on the peak day, we consume 28,000 megawatts of electricity. Sorry, Brian. On a peak day, we consume 28,000 megawatts of electricity in New England. The installed capacity of the New England grid is 33,000 megawatts. So clearly, New England doesn't need the power. The other energy and consumer issues involved here, there are many of them. It's not an area where the Forest Society has a lot of expertise, but I think it's important to point out that nobody's talking about anyone's power bill going down as a result of doing this project. What they talk about is competitively priced power. Now, what is competitively priced power? In New England, if this project is built, it's going to sell its electricity into the New England wholesale market, and it's going to bid that power in on a daily basis. And if it's true that their cost to generate this electricity is between 2 and 3 cents a kilowatt hour, that is indeed cheap, and it's indeed cheaper than most power that's generated in New England. But the way the market works, they bid that power in, and they get paid not what they bid in, but they get paid the highest price of any generating station that actually goes online at the time energy is being put into the grid. So if the highest priced power online at any given time is 7.5 or 8 cents, and they bid 4 cents, which is 100% markup on their 2 cents, they're going to get 7.5 or 8 cents. So that's what competitively priced power means when you hear those words. Environmental issues, or excuse me, economic issues, I think there is a legitimate argument that this project will provide short-term jobs. I think there's a legitimate argument that this project, if built, would provide a little bit of tax revenue for towns. In fact, one of the reasons why Franklin is so excited about this project is because in Franklin, this project, if built, would host $250 million investment in that station, which changes DC power to AC power. And that $250 million investment will generate $5 million a year in tax revenue to the city of Franklin, which is about 40% of the total tax take in the city of Franklin today. So it's understandable why the mayor and the city council are very supportive of the project. And that is that you can't deny that there's a benefit there. But what they don't talk about, and one of the biggest unanswered questions today, and Peter Powell from Lancaster will talk more about this in a minute, is what are the impacts on property values? If you own a piece of land over which this right-of-way goes, what's going to be the impact on the value of your home if, where there's now a 45-foot tower, you have a 135-foot tower? And I think those kinds of questions really need to be explored, because on the surface, it appears as though where they require new rights-of-way, the impact on property values will be very, very significant. And where they require putting higher towers in existing rights of way, there will be maybe a smaller diminution of value, but there will be a diminution of value. So, and the other thing we have to keep in mind is that if everybody's property values go down along the line, then everybody else's in town, everybody else's taxes are going to go up.
Still pay tax on that.
Well, right now, if you own land over which a utility right-of-way goes, you own that land, and you're still paying taxes on that land. Now, the utility company also pays a separate utility tax. But, yeah, you retain the pleasure of paying property taxes on rights-of-way happen to go over your land. Environmental issues, there's a couple of other big-picture economic issues that projects like this very rarely properly address. One of them is, what are the impacts on the immediate regional local economies of the towns through which this power line is going to go? You know, in the North Country of New Hampshire, and I think this is the reason why so many people got so upset about this when it was first proposed, in the North Country, up in Coos County, the landscape is the economy. It's the culture. It's why people live up there. It's how they earn their daily living. And when you put a scar on the landscape, you scar the economy. And that's something that people who live up there, and I've talked to a lot of them, there are a number of them here tonight, are just very, very distressed about. Because once you put something like this through the landscape of a place like Coos County, it's there for good. I mean, the damage is done. You can't undo it. And the perception is, and I will admit that I haven't seen any good economic work done yet, but this is something that we believe that the Department of Energy should be doing as part of its environmental impact statement, as a thorough socioeconomic analysis for every alternative that they study, and talk a little bit more about that in a second. But there are some very significant economic issues that this project raises. Environmental issues, there will certainly be ecological impacts on forests and land, no matter where they locate something like this. Those impacts are going to be there. And the impacts on scenic landscapes, which is one of the reasons that we've gotten so involved in this, once you create those impacts, they don't go away. And the reality is that 135 feet is a heck of a lot taller than most mature trees that grow in the state of New Hampshire.
Will you explain at some point why the
tower has to be so tall? I will try to explain it. I'm not sure I'll get it right, but essentially, has everybody seen the DC line in the western part of the state? You'll know there are two. I have a picture of this, I think. I'll get to it in a second, but when I get to that picture, I'll explain it. Some of the energy questions that I'd like to put on the table that I think are unanswered is, you know, one is this a good investment of $1.1 billion? The promoters of this project are fond of saying this isn't going to cost the ratepayer anything because it's a participant-funded project, which means that Hydro-Quebec is going to pay for this project out of their own wallets. Well, sure they are, but they're going to recapture that $1.1 billion through the electricity charges that they collect from sale of the electricity. And I think something this large, if in the end we're going to pay for it, shouldn't somebody be asking the question, is this the best way to spend $1.1 billion? I mean, for example, say you invested $1.1 billion in energy conservation, and you could save 2,400 megawatts a year. Now, I'm inventing these numbers for the purpose of making an argument, but the point is, there may be bigger returns from a societal investment of this size by making that investment in other ways than is being proposed here. At no point in the regulatory process is that question even asked, let alone answered. Will Northern Pass crowd out other renewables? Well, if 1,200 megawatts of inexpensive, competitively priced Canadian power comes to southern New England, What's the incentive for investors to invest in small-scale, independent renewable energy projects in New Hampshire? It's gone. I mean, there's just literally no financial reason why anybody looking to make a return on investment would invest in alternative energy, biomass, wind, or anything if we're already getting 1,200 megawatts of quote-unquote renewable power from Canada.
Should we be concerned about the over-reliance on Hydro-Quebec for electricity? Well, I don't know where that point comes, but right now there's over 3,500 megawatts coming into the United to the northeastern United States. And, you know, at what point should we start worrying that we're becoming over-dependent on another foreign source of energy? It's a fair question, and it's not getting asked or answered. Will New Hampshire consumers of electricity have any access to this power? So far, the answer to this question is no. The only access we will have, if you're a customer of Public Service of New Hampshire and you purchase your electricity from them, and they are buying on the wholesale market a little bit of this power from the wholesale distributor in New England, you might see some of this electricity, but you're not going to see much. And a couple of people who've done some analysis of this suggest that the financial benefit of seeing it is very small. It's minuscule. If NU does sell some of this power to PSNH, do we even need it? Well, the answer is that PSNH actually does need more power to sell than they generate at their own generating stations. But as we were talking about earlier, there's plenty of power being produced in the state of New Hampshire, so they should be buying it from other producers that exist now. I mean, to give you an example, there are six power plants, biomass power plants, in central and northern New Hampshire that are on the edge of going under right now because they can't afford to sell their electricity at rates that are competitive on the market and on the wholesale market. And the reality is that Public Service Company in New Hampshire, if they claim that they need to buy more power, and they do, and, you know, I think I've heard that they're thinking about announcing in the near future a purchase power agreement where I think they will negotiate this with themselves, actually, but they would buy 100 megawatts or 120 megawatts of power directly from this Hydro-Quebec project, and they would use it to supplement their own power needs. Well, I guess my question is, why would you want to build a $1.1 billion power line that scars the center of New Hampshire and when you already have the potential of buying 100 megawatts of biomass power from existing plants that are operating, that are providing New Hampshire jobs, where the money stays in the state of New Hampshire, 100% of it stays here? Why is that such a difficult thing? I mean, it's mind-boggling. Economic questions. We talked earlier about the direct benefits. The company, a public service company, has made a very clear they've hired an economist to articulate these job benefits and the tax benefits, but as I said earlier, they haven't talked about a lot of the other economic costs, and they haven't valued those costs in the same with the same rigor that they've identified the benefits. Will the power actually provide a reduction or greater stability in the price that we pay for electricity? I don't think so. Is it possible to quantify the economic values of New Hampshire's landscape that will be negatively impacted? These are things, as we talked about a minute ago, that need to happen. We need to have more understanding of this. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that we know for sure that the economic costs are going to be hugely out of line with the benefits. My gut tells me that that's the case, but the decision makers need to know the answer to that question before they decide to give a green or red light to this. Environmental questions. Is the power really renewable? I think that's probably debatable. I'm not going to go into the debate right now, but if there's anybody here who is interested, I think I can point you to a number of sources of information where you can get a really healthy understanding of this debate. Is the power green? When I first heard about this project, I actually served on Governor Lynch's climate change task force with the president of Public Service Company and about 25 other people. And when he first brought this idea, this was in the concept stage a couple years ago, to the attention of this climate change task force, he suggested that there would be a net savings of something like 6 million metric tons of carbon dioxide a year. When this project was announced last October, that number dropped to 5 million.
And when we had a meeting with the project director last November, in fact, it was the day before the election, we asked her point blank, well, what's the foundation for this claim of 5 million metric tons of saved carbon? And she said, well, we're doing a study and we'll share it with you when it's done. And the next week, that 5 million number went down to 1.2 to 2 million. So I think the honest answer is they don't know, and it depends. And I think there needs to be more factual research done on that to give some credibility to that claim.
Will?
Yeah.
Have any of these studies, to your knowledge, looked at the impact in Canada of taking 7 million acres out of carbon-absorbing forests and letting that material rot under reservoirs and emit greenhouse gases as part of the net annual?
Well, two answers. One is the Conservation Law Foundation, which is another organization here in New Hampshire, which is working actively on this, is actually doing a research review with some Canadian partners on that very question as we speak. And I haven't seen any analysis out of that, but as soon as it's available, we'll certainly put it on our website. The other thing is, and I'm not as familiar with the work that Hydro-Québec has done, there was a very interesting article, and if you Google the Montreal Gazette, last Friday there was a really interesting article in the Montreal Gazette that talked about some of the research that Hydro-Québec has done. And aside from citing three or four examples where they essentially put the kibosh on any public release of this information that was done by independent scientists when it didn't favor the result that they desired, I think they addressed this point, at least not directly but indirectly, of the carbon impacts. And there have been studies done by Hydro-Québec and by other independent scientists in Canada on this subject, and that's what the CLF folks are reviewing right now. The question is this subsidized power? Well, in Quebec, and I'm not going to get the precise numbers correct here, but there is a provincial law in Quebec which restricts the price at which Hydro-Quebec's generating entity can sell electricity to its distribution company. And it's somewhere in the range of 2.9 cents per kilowatt hour. They're not allowed to sell. Now, this isn't the retail price we're talking about. This is the wholesale price. So Hydro-Québec has a generating division, and they have a distribution division. Their generating division can only sell electricity in Quebec on the wholesale market at a price at or below 2.9 cents. Now, how do they do that? Well, one of the ways they do it is by selling surplus power, generating more power than they need, and or selling power to outside of Quebec at prices much higher than 2.9 cents per kilowatt hour. That's how, I mean, they have, you got to give these guys credit. 40 years ago, they sat down and developed a master plan, and their master plan was basically keeping prices low in Quebec by selling high in the United States. And it's working. You know, they've come up with a plan that is working masterfully. And I would argue that if we in New England, if the six New England states had done the same kind of strategic thinking and planning 40 years ago that the folks in Quebec did, we wouldn't be here tonight. But that's a whole other story. Impacts on health. I am particularly uninformed on the health impacts, but there's been a lot of research done on the electromagnetic field impacts on human and animal health, and for anybody who's interested in that, I actually know somebody who's done quite a bit of research on that. Another thing that's worthy of mentioning on the human health impacts, or for that matter, the health of the entire biosphere, in order to keep these power lines clear of vegetation, they use herbicides and pesticides.
what's going to be the impact of those herbicides and pesticides long-term if they're used with any rigor on this power line? That's a question that ought to be asked and answered by the decision makers who decide whether this is going to happen or not. Are there alternatives for the transmission of this power that have less negative environmental impacts? I think the honest answer is we don't know the answer to this question today. I mean, I can give you my gut reactions to the answer to this, but until there's a rigorous analysis done, I don't think we know whether there are credible alternatives or not. This is to the question that was asked earlier about the power lines themselves. This is actually taken in Dunbarton, New Hampshire, and this is the National Grid right-of-way. National Grid owns this line right here. This is a high-voltage AC line and a high-voltage AC line over here. These lines originate at Comerford Dam. This line originates in Windsor, Quebec, which is the same location where the Northern Pass power line would originate. And that's the point at which alternating current in Quebec is changed into direct current for the purpose of transmitting it long distance. This power line, if you look at the width of this power line here, it's about, I think, 225 feet wide. The whole corridor is about 400 feet wide right here, but they don't clear the whole 400 feet. The question that I was talking about earlier, you know, somebody needs to do a thorough assessment of whether this existing corridor could be used in some way, shape, or form for the Northern Pass project. Well, that's a really good question. The question was, if Hydro-Quebec already has a way of getting electricity down to southern New England, why would they need to build the Northern Pass line that's been proposed? I can speculate on a couple of reasons of why that might be, and it would only be speculation. But I think one issue, and I think this is a fair issue, in order to convert this power line to carry 3,200 megawatts or more, they would probably have to put new cables up. They would probably have to put new towers up because there has to be a certain separation based on the amount of electricity, the voltage of the electricity, and the volume of electricity going through the lines. There has to be a certain spatial separation of these cables from one another and from these cables from these and these from each other. And that's, I'm maxing out on my knowledge of electricity. But the point here is that in order to replace the capacity above ground for those lines to be expanded, it would be a 2 to 3 year construction project. They would lose the sale of 2,000 megawatts of power daily for 2 to 3 years, which is big money. So that's one reason. There are others which we might speculate on.
Isn't it true that that line is owned by National Grid, and so they'd have to make a deal with National Grid beyond the cost of...
That's correct. And, I mean, from Northeast Utilities' standpoint, you know, they don't generate as much annual revenue if they share it with National Grid. So there's a disincentive there. The good news about this whole project from a regulatory perspective is that the federal government can essentially order them to deal with one another if it becomes clear that that's the path of least resistance. Well, these two lines, the two alternating current lines, originate at Comerford Dam in Monroe. This line, the big line, it goes through Comerford, but it actually crosses the Connecticut River in Littleton, goes through the Northeast Kingdom, it crosses the international boundary at Norton, Vermont, and then it goes about 45 miles north.
Those the lines Yes.
Yeah.
How tall is that tallest tower?
How tall is that? That's about 90 feet. So what we're talking about for Northern Pass is at least that high, and I don't know how, it depends on the topography and what other power lines are in the existing right-of-way, but I don't know what the ultimate determinant is at any given point of the, whether it's 90 feet or 135 feet. I've even heard that some of these towers maybe have to be taller than 135 feet in order to stay within the narrow corridors that exist, for example, in the White Mountain National Forest. That corridor is 150 feet wide. I don't think they expect to get any further encroachment beyond 150 feet. There's an existing AC line there, and depending on who you talk to, it's pretty clear that in order to get everything into that 150 feet, they may have to actually construct towers taller than what so far they said they would need to.
135 feet, equivalent of a
11-story building? Yes, or maybe even a 13-story building.
So how does that increase the base that has to hold the tower?
How does it increase the, well, if you had to, I don't know the specifics, but you have to put concrete into the ground in order to hold these towers up. And the heavier the cable, the heavier the tower, the more tower you erect, the more concrete you have to pour. I'm not aware that anybody has looked at any configuration in the existing right-of-way, which was my point, that ought to be fully exhausted. You know, what you just suggested, I don't think anybody's looked at burying, if you're Hydro-Quebec and you want to increase your exports to New Hampshire or New England or New York, maybe if you can bury something here and replace these overhead lines with something that can carry 5 or 8,000 megawatts, why not just build something today that does what all your future needs are going to be for the next 20 years? The fear that a lot of people have about Northern Pass, particularly up north, is that, you know, power lines have babies, and once you build one, you know, they're gonna multiply. And I think that's a legitimate fear, considering what they've already said their long-term plan is to increase exports. It has to come in somewhere. Yeah. John?
According to Hydro-Quebec engineers that we met in the East Area of Quebec, one of the benefits of the 135-plus foot towers is that you can run an AC line halfway up on the same towers.
Yeah.
When you say Hydro,
that means that the dividends they pay are to the province of, to the taxpayers of Quebec. They're not listed on any stock exchange. They're owned entirely by the province of Quebec.
For what it's worth, I was wondering about this matter of using the existing right-of-way, which the DC line runs up through Vermont. I emailed them a week ago, Northern Pass, and asked that question. Why they didn't use that existing?
Well, if they were assuming that they were going to build an entirely new power line in that general vicinity, yeah, they would have to expand the right-of-way. But did you ask them about using the existing?
No, I didn't know about the ownership issue, and they weren't aware of the possibilities of using the same line twice.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're interested in reading about about the proposal that's before the federal government right now. If you go to www.northernpasseis.us, and I think there's printed material out here that has that address on it, you can read the application this woman is explaining. And they do talk in some detail about what these constructed things will look like when they're done. I want to finish up here because I know we've got two other speakers. This is John and Cindy Lou Amy, who are here from Pittsburgh. This is their farm, the Indian Stream Farm. And this farm, in an earlier life, I ran a land conservation program for the state of New Hampshire and acquired a conservation easement for the state on 1,100 acres. That's 1,100, right? Protecting this whole property, or most of the property. And fortunately, the preferred corridor comes into Pittsburgh south of here, but one of the preferred corridors comes up through here, north of the property. And I can assure you that I don't think John ever would have granted this easement. I don't want to put words in your mouth, John, if he knew that someday he was going to have the good fortune to look out at 135-foot or even 90-foot towers. One of the reasons we protected this farm was because of the scenic view you see here. And that view would be destroyed if you had to look. This is a gateway to the town of Pittsburgh, for those of you who haven't been up there. It's absolutely gorgeous. This is a view looking to the north, northeast actually, from our Rocks Estate in Bethlehem. And I put this up here to show these towers are 45 foot tall right now. The new towers coming through here would be 90 to 135 foot tall. And I, you know, just to, the, for the perspective of the mature trees, when you're driving on the roads down here, pretty much hide these towers because of the elevation of the trees. That won't happen when this new power line is built. So the whole perspective of this valley will be changed. This is another view of the, this is actually taken in Haverhill, I think, where the towers cross the road, Route 116. The regulatory review process, I want to cover this real quick. I think most of you know what this project needs to go through. The presidential permit application, which is a decision made by the Department of Energy to grant what's called a presidential permit. This authorizes the proposer of this project to import power over the international border. And there are something like 80 of these permits in existence today. I don't think the Department of Energy has ever said no to one of these applications. I don't think they've ever had an application that has been quite as contested as this. The good news is that they're on their toes. Our congressional delegation is keeping them on their toes, and I think we have a fair shot at having a much higher rigor applied to the environmental impact statement being done for this project than has ever been done on a prior presidential permit application. But the real decision that's going to be made here is going to be by the New Hampshire Site Evaluation Committee. This is the entity that state law created for deciding where to locate power projects, whether they're generating stations or power line transmission systems like this. The plan that the applicant has, once the draft environmental impact statement is published by the Department of Energy, which again, it looks like it's going to be in about a year's time, the applicant will then apply for a site evaluation committee certificate. The Site Evaluation Committee is chaired by Tom Burek, who's the Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Services, all three Public Utility Commissioners, the Commissioner of the Department of Resources and Economic Development, the State Forester, the State Director of Parks, the State Historic Preservation Officer, and I'm forgetting one or two others, but they're all state agency folks. And they're all good people. I know most of these people. And but this process, this process, I have to be honest, both the Department of Energy process for the presidential permit and the Site Evaluation Committee process, these processes are not designed to independently weigh yes or no. They're designed to get to yes. And we have to recognize the fact that the purpose for which these entities, these governmental review agencies exist, is to try and make things work, not to try and stop them. So what we're asking these folks to do is something that's contrary to all of the DNA in their governmental process. And we can't forget that. And a third permit that's necessary, the Department of Agriculture needs to grant what's called a special use permit for the project to go through the White Mountain National Forest. The project's proposed corridor has 10 miles that it goes through the National Forest, and in order for that 10 miles to be built, it needs this special use permit. Tom Wagner, who's the forest supervisor, is the person who will make this decision. He was at all seven of the DOE hearings as an officer of the USDA, and it will be his job to render the final decision on whether this goes through the National Forest or not. Finally, the New Hampshire Public Utilities Commission, if there is a request from PSNH to buy some of this power for its customers, the Public Utilities Commission will have to agree to allow that purchase power agreement to be accepted. And that will be a public review process. So there are at least three different processes, and there are more permits that are necessary for this project, but on the order of magnitude, those are the big ones. I'm happy to talk with anybody else afterwards about what the Forest Society is doing here, because I really want to move on. We are working with other conservation organizations daily on this, and we're trying to work with the regional planning commissions, the North Country Council, and the other regional planning commissions that actually do serve the towns that are impacted by the project. Our principal goal right now is to reach out to communities statewide, like we're doing tonight, and talk with people about what this is all about. Because the only way this project doesn't go forward is if people who really don't want it to go forward stand up and get counted. If we all sit on our hands, I guarantee you this thing will be built. The review process, I didn't go into a lot of detail about this, but the Department of Energy's review process, this environmental impact statement, one of the things that they have to do under law, as part of under the National Environmental Policy Act, they are required to do what's called an alternatives analysis in an EIS. So they have to look at these alternatives. We've talked about a number of them tonight. And our argument is, yes, you should look at the current existing 2,000 megawatt line and a number of different variations on how you might be able to use that corridor to get this power to market so we don't have to create another SCAR. We ought to look at existing transportation corridors. There are abandoned railroad beds all up and down the states of New Hampshire and Vermont. There are interstate highway systems north-south. In fact, there's one that goes from Montreal directly to Hartford. Be perfect for if you wanted to bury a power line and you get it to southern New England. What more could you ask for? You only have to deal with one landowner, and that's the federal government. And I'm making it sound simple. I know it's not. But the point is that there are alternatives worth studying. That's what this is about, studying credible alternatives. So the Department of Energy held these seven meetings. Tomorrow was originally going to be the deadline for filing public comments, written comments. And there's literature out front with addresses. You can email your comments. You can snail mail your comments. My understanding is that we haven't seen any official notice yet, but I understand from talking with staff of our congressional delegation that the Department of Energy will announce tomorrow that they're extending the public comment period for another 60 days. So if you hear people saying the comment period ends April 12th, that's actually what it says on the website. But our understanding is that the Secretary of Energy has agreed to extend the comment period for another 2 months beyond tomorrow. I want to stipulate that it hasn't appeared in writing anywhere. So, the last thing I want to talk about is this House legislation. I mentioned earlier that the New Hampshire Constitution has a simple one-sentenced amendment that was passed in 2006, which basically says that eminent domain cannot be conferred by the state to a private developer for the benefit of a private development project. I don't have the exact language there, but the point of this amendment was stirred by a Supreme Court decision in 2005, the Kelo decision, which essentially the Supreme Court validated a private taking of land in New London, Connecticut by Pfizer Corporation for the purposes of an economic development project. As a result of that Supreme Court decision, New Hampshire was one of 30-plus states that adopted this constitutional amendment. House Bill 648 is designed to bring the state's existing eminent domain law, as it applies to utilities, into sync with that constitutional amendment. Because right now it's vague what the, you know, when you hold the amendment up to the statute, which was passed long before the amendment was adopted, they're not in sync. And in fairness, I think they should be. So the argument has been made. The House adopted this legislation, I think 86% to 14%, 317 to 51. Overwhelming majority, all people on both sides of the political fence said, no, we shouldn't be allowing eminent domain to be used by a power company or power transmission company that's proposing to build a private project that doesn't have any sanction by either the independent system operator, which is of New England, which provides wholesale electricity pricing and sales, or by a determination of need. And if that bit legislation passes the Senate, it will then go on to the governor. I'm not sure the governor wants this thing in his lap, and I'm not sure what he would do if it came to him, but I am sure that if it doesn't come to him, I have to speak up. Can you hear? Hello? Is that any better? If the governor doesn't get this bill because it doesn't get the necessary 13 votes, in the Senate, then my view is we haven't done our job well enough. But if the governor does get the bill and he signs it into law, I think it's very clear that this project will have to go back to the drawing board, at least for that part of the project that requires the acquisition of new rights of way. So I should probably stop there and turn the microphone over to Peter and then Bob Baker. But if anybody has any quick questions, be glad to try and answer them. Yeah.
It's really out of left field, but I'm surprised that Vermont hasn't come into the discussion at all, because they seem to have power needs, or will soon have power needs, and New Hampshire doesn't have it. And then what do you mention Vermont?
Yeah, the question was, he's surprised that Vermont hasn't entered into this discussion. Actually, they have. They just haven't done it with a lot of fanfare. The governor of Vermont is interested in retiring the nuclear plant over there, and I don't remember how many megawatts of power it generates, but this project could very easily, or a separate project with Hydro-Quebec, could very easily fill that need. And my understanding is that the state of Vermont has either negotiated or is in the process of negotiating a purchase of Hydro-Quebec power with the goal of replacing the power at the nuclear plant. Susan. The question is, what is the disincentive for using railroad right-of-ways? This is my off-the-cuff response. It's more expensive. And the first volley was to put the cheapest card on the table. They put the cheapest card on the table, and it didn't play very well. So now I think they'll go back to a drawing board somewhere. And my guess is that you'll see something. The next iteration of the next cheapest alternative will have some combination of burial and above-ground transmission. I think if I heard Susan correctly, she's
suggesting that it must be cheaper to bury it under an existing railroad line than going on the existing Hydro-Quebec line, or existing National Grid line. I'm beginning to get into an area where I don't have as much knowledge as I should to intelligently answer that. But again, all of those alternatives should be on the table that DOE considers when they look at this set of alternatives in the environmental impact statement. And one of the things that we are going to need to press our congressional delegation on, and I think they're willing to work for us on this, we need to make certain that the process by which these alternatives that are going to be studied, we need to make certain that that process is open, transparent, and that there's a thorough analysis done, public analysis done, before they start spending a lot of money on looking at alternatives, that they've got the right batch of alternatives to begin with. And it's not clear that the track record of the Department of Energy on this front is not good from our perspective. Doesn't mean they can't do a much more rigorous review this time, but we need to hold their feet to the fire. And to the credit of our congressional delegation, so far they've been willing to do that. There was an individual who spoke at the Colebrook Department hearing, I think, who said something, what you were saying, in one quick sentence, and he said, there's no right way to do the wrong thing. I'll take one more question, and I'll take one more question and then turn it over to Peter Powell. I think there are materials out back. As you leave, I'll make sure you, if anybody leaves here without that information, see Lisa or myself, and we'll make sure you get it, or one of the folks in wearing an orange shirt. I want to introduce Peter Powell, who I've known a long time. He's from Lancaster. And he can introduce himself, but he's been doing a lot of really good work on trying to better understand the impact of this power utility transmission line, its impact on property value. So, Peter, do you have slides?